Physicist David Weintraub with us. His work is called Life on Mars. He's got another book called Religions and Extraterrestrial Life. And we shall be back with a full hour to go with your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with David Weintraub, physicist, as we talk about life on Mars and other things going on in the universe. David, I bet when you were a youngster, you loved science, didn't you?
I did. I'm not sure exactly why or how that fascination began, but I loved books and I loved reading. And I was a child during that race to the moon we were talking about earlier, and that captured my interest.
How old were you when you got your first telescope?
Oh, I was probably about 12.
That does it too, doesn't it? Do you remember looking at Saturn and you see the little rings around it?
No, I remember looking at the moon. I'm not sure I was wise enough at the time to figure out what the planets were and how to find those.
Yeah.
It was a pretty primitive telescope.
It was
easy to find.
I mean, I loved looking at Saturn, and then when I looked at Jupiter, you could see four of its zillion moons popping up.
Yeah, the moons of Jupiter and the rings of Saturn are wonderful, and you actually don't need a telescope, just a good binocular.
Mm-hmm.
You can see them.
Which tells you another thing. This is a gorgeous universe. I mean, it is just, when you think of it, I mean, we just had the snow moon a couple nights ago. It was just gorgeous.
It certainly is. I think most of us don't spend enough time enjoying and appreciating that. We live inside. We live with streetlights and artificial lighting everywhere, and we don't look up at night or even during the daytime. You don't need the stars and the planets. You've got birds and trees. And I think most of us don't even appreciate that much.
I was in St. Louis a couple of years ago, David, when we had the solar eclipse. And that was so dramatic. I mean, even for the moment that it would get dark and then get bright again, I mean, it was emotional. It really was.
The total solar eclipse from, I guess, a year and a half ago, August 2017, was, for me, one of the most spectacular, dramatic events I've ever experienced. That was my first total solar eclipse.
Oh, wow.
It came right over my house. I had 200 people in my front yard, and all the neighbors, and we had telescopes, and it was absolutely awe-inspiring.
I bought some cardboard glasses from Amazon. And then about a week later, before the event, they send out an urgent message. There's something wrong. We think that we purchased these from some fraud company. Please don't use them. They aren't what we think they were. But thank God I got some from somebody else.
Yeah, I suspect that was overly protective on their parts. I don't know what the flaw was or how critical the flaw was. I had gotten actually about 10,000 pairs of eclipse glasses distributed by the American Astronomical Society. So I knew they were good quality.
Pretty authentic, yeah.
Most of them I gave away to schools. I spent 6 months going around to schools around Tennessee, talking to students to get them interested and excited about the eclipse, and I gave out lots of glasses. Hopefully they all worked, because I didn't hear about anybody getting hurt.
You know, we've been talking about the other planetary systems, Mars, what might be out there in the universe. Pluto was a planet. Now it was a planetoid. What the heck happened to it?
Well, the correct term, supposedly, for Pluto now is it is a dwarf planet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a reasonable descriptor for Pluto.
So it's still a planet.
But a dwarf planet is a planet. It's just a little one. The Earth is a rocky planet or a terrestrial planet. Jupiter is a giant planet or a gaseous planet or even a gas giant planet. We have gas giant planets and icy giant planets and icy dwarf planets. Pluto's an icy dwarf planet. I think what you need are adjectives in front of the word planet. And Pluto is an adjectivally compromised planet, but so is every other planet.
Why did they bump it out in the first place?
Beginning about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, astronomers began to discover other objects in the part of the solar system where Pluto lives. And we now know that Pluto is the largest or one of the largest objects in what we call the Kuiper Belt, which is similar to the asteroid belt. The asteroid belt is in between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, so fairly close to the Sun in a large sense. The Kuiper belt is beyond the eight big planets. You have to pass Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune, and then you get to the Kuiper belt, and that's where Pluto is. And we now know of a handful of other objects that are comparable in size to Pluto. One is called Eris. One is called Makemake. There are a bunch of them, and some astronomers felt that was too many planets. For some reason, some people think that stars should only have 6 or 7 or 8 planets, that 10 or 12 or 15 is too big a number. It makes planets less important. So they wanted to demote Pluto, and they may have succeeded, but I think what they did is they simply helped us think about planets a little bit differently. I don't think that's what they think they did, but I think that's what they think they did. That the right way to talk about planets is to describe them. So you asked about exoplanets before. Exoplanet is effectively just like a planet. It just has the descriptor exo in front of it, which tells you that an exoplanet is a planet that orbits another star. And Pluto is a dwarf planet, which tells you it's a very tiny little planet, but it's a planet.
Let's go to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. You will find, David, that he is an amateur astronomer. Hey, Bill,
right.
Go ahead.
Hey, Bill.
Yes, hi, George. It's nice being on the show again. Yes, Doctor, I am an amateur astronomer, and I do own the Meade 6-inch ACF light switch telescope. It's fantastic.
Nice telescope.
3 years now.
Nice job. So,
yes. Now, I'm looking at the science magazine, Science Focus, the most recent one. The title is Inside Mars. It's about NASA's Mars InSight mission. I want to ask you a question about that. It says on the cover, "What will we uncover beneath the red planet's surface?" Let me read you two brief, quick sentences and ask my question. It says, quote, "The red planet has been an object of intrigue for centuries, and an armada of orbiters, landers, and rovers have explored Mars up close. Yet for all our exploration efforts, there remains a perplexing mystery. Just what is going on deep within Mars?" And one more sentence here. "If all goes according to plan, and these experiments of Mars InSight all work as intended, we'll finally get crucial information about the most unexplored part of the most explored planet in the solar system." And my question to you is about the two main instruments on Mars InSight, the SEISMR, S-E-I-S-M-R, the seismometer that's going to look for Mars quakes, as well as sort of the MOLE instrument, the HP3, the heat flow and physical properties probe. And my question specifically is, has the seismometer, along with the cover to it, been deployed successfully, as well as the heat flow probe? Has that been starting to hammer down into the Martian surface? And assuming both these probes are successfully deployed on Mars, when will we get the data back to the general public?
Those are great questions, and you certainly are well versed in what's going on with the InSight mission. I don't have answers for you. I know that InSight landed successfully. I remember reading at some point that it had successfully deployed one of the instruments, but I don't know which of those instruments it was. As far as getting science back from InSight, certainly we don't have anything yet. I would think that by the one-year anniversary of the landing of InSight, which would be next November, it landed on the Monday after Thanksgiving, so it's only been on the surface for 2 months now. And 2 months is barely enough time to make sure engineering-wise that we know what we're doing. It's not enough time to collect enough data to really understand what's going on inside Mars. It's certainly not enough time to analyze and understand the data. I worry a lot about science being done by press conference, that as soon as you have some information, you have a press conference and announce it to the world, and then you discover a week or a month later that you actually said some stupid things about your data because you hadn't spent enough time in the laboratory understanding your data, understanding the noise associated with any measurement, and then you have to correct your mistakes. So I would prefer that we be patient, that NASA be patient, that the scientific teams be patient, get their data, analyze it really carefully, and then make their announcements when they're really sure about what they've discovered. But I would think the one-year anniversary of landing on Mars would be long enough that we would have some good measurements, some good data, and understand the data. But I haven't seen any timeline for that, and I don't think NASA would want to give you one. I think, you know, listening for Mars quakes, we may never hear one, in which case you want to listen for a long time and make sure that you understand extremely well how sensitive your instruments are before you announce that you haven't discovered a Mars quake. Or if you make such a discovery, you want to make sure that you understand that it wasn't because a meteorite hit the surface of Mars rather than there being an actual quake inside Mars, and you have to learn how to tell the difference between those types of signals. So I think we just have to be patient. But I haven't seen any announcements of any scientific results yet, and I don't know which instruments have been successfully deployed yet.
David, 50 years ago in July, we had landed two brave astronauts on the moon. Nobody's been able to do that since. We were way ahead of the game, but they're catching up to us now, technologically, aren't they?
There are lots of countries that are capable of getting to the moon, though not of sending humans to the moon yet. Certainly, China's gone to the moon, and India has gone to the moon, and there was an announcement, I think, that a company in Israel is about to launch a spacecraft to the moon.
Yep.
Russia can go to the moon.
This week, if they haven't done it already.
Yeah. In terms of unmanned probes to the moon is almost easy pickings now.
Next up, let's go to Kathy in Idaho. Hi, Kath. Welcome to the program.
Well, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. What a fascinating program you have.
Sure is. Thank you.
And, you know, I love science, but then I have to go look at the Gospel of St. John and your question. George, you remember your catechism?
I do.
Where did it all begin? Well, it's right there, chapter 1, Gospel of Jesus Christ according to St. John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was made nothing that was made.
I want to know who made God. That's what I want to know, Kathy. How'd he get here? What do you think?
As we discussed earlier, at the moment, science can only take us so far, and religion provides an answer to the question about the beginning. It's not a scientific answer, but it is an answer that if you accept that gospel, then it's an answer that you embrace and believe. But religion is about believing, not about proving scientifically. So there are different ways of getting knowledge about the universe. And what we're talking about, what in my career, what professional scientists are trying to do, is use the tools of science to provide answers to questions. And the question, was there a beginning? How did the beginning happen? At the moment, that the answer to that question is beyond the limits of science, which is why a lot of people will seek an answer to questions like that in areas that are beyond science.
And do you think too, David, and I don't want to seem blasphemous by any means, but that religions make this thing sound so easy when we're trying to figure out, oh my gosh, how did this really start? And then why did it start? You simply say God created everything and you leave it at that. I mean, I want answers. And to me,
I wouldn't want to characterize religion as providing easy answers, but they provide very satisfying answers, very clean answers, and science doesn't always do that. Sometimes the answers we get from science are unsatisfying, such as not understanding why the Big Bang happened in the first place. And I think people want answers. They want to know with some degree of finality what the answer to their questions are, especially the most important questions, the hardest questions. Why are we here, right?
Yep.
And science can't give us an answer to a question like that.
No, so it may never give us an answer. Yeah, we've been looking for that answer since the beginning of time, and we don't have it.
Right. So they're tough questions, but they're not. They're not all scientific questions.
East of the Rockies, Carl's with us in Dothan, Alabama. Hello, Carl. Thanks for calling.
Hello, George. Thank you for taking my call, and yes, hello sir. To David. I couldn't ask for a better night than to have David grounded in science, and we all know what George is into. So here's my proposition for you. NASA recently realized their windows were getting dirty on the space station, so they went out and cleaned them. And in the process, they also analyzed what they took off the glass. And what they found is the same little amoeba, protozoa, or whatever that supposedly evolved from the primordial sludge into humans. Now, you were saying earlier that it takes a while to develop intelligence. Given the fact these bugs are out there in space, what's the chance of them infecting another planet like Earth, but a million years prior? And instead of evolving into humans, they evolved into what George knows as the bug-eyed gray.
Well, I haven't read what you read about cleaning the windshields of the space station, so you're ahead of me on that one. But you need to realize that the space station is pretty close to Earth. We think of it as being out in space, but it really is only 150 or so miles above the surface of the Earth. The radius of the Earth is 6,000 miles. So it's not very high. It's not very far from the Earth. And anything that's covering the windshield of the space station is from the Earth. It's from the atmosphere of the Earth.
Yeah, here's that story for us, David. Scientists in November have detected living bacteria from outer space in samples collected from the exterior of the International Space Station during spacewalks. Cosmonaut Anton Shapovalov told the Russian state-owned TASS news agency. These spacewalks were conducted by cosmonauts who apparently collected material from the Russian part of the ISS using cotton swabs, which were then sent back to planet Earth.
Yeah, that's really interesting to read about. The part of that I would question is what is meant and what we should understand by saying bacteria from outer space. They collected bacteria that was from the surface of the space station. That doesn't provide evidence that the bacteria came from beyond the Earth, which is how we would normally understand outer space.
It might have been from the space station and somehow survived outside.
Might have been from one of the Dragon capsules that went up there to resupply the space station. I mean, there's a lot of polluting of that part of the atmosphere, if you will, the very outer atmosphere. The space station is designed to be in very low Earth orbit so we can get to it. And that actually means it is not truly in outer space, truly beyond all of the Earth's atmosphere. The Earth's atmosphere is very, very, very thin up there, but there is stuff up there. It surprises me a little bit that there will be bacteria up there, but it doesn't shock me. And again, chances are pretty good that we just took that stuff with us.
David, would you be surprised if governments disclosed that we have been visited by extraterrestrials? Would that shock you? Would you say, well, I probably knew that? Or would you say, oh my gosh?
Well, I wouldn't say that I knew that because I doubt we've been visited by extraterrestrials. What would surprise me would be if we had been visited by aliens, it would surprise me that any government could possibly cover it up. So I seriously doubt that the government is hiding anything from us. And in that respect, they just can't keep secrets very well.
All right, well, stay with us. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with David Weintraub. We'll tell you where you can get his books as well. His website is part of the Vanderbilt educational system, which is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. But those of you on hold, just stay where you are. We will get you when we come back. Next hour, poltergeists, moving graveyards, haunted hospitals. I'm looking forward to that. So stick around here on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll be back with physicist David Weintraub in a moment and take final phone calls as well. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, David Weintraub with us. David, where do people get your books, my friend?
Well, like everybody, Amazon is pretty typically the easiest place to go. I would like to think that we all have local bookstores that would carry them, but I think they'd be hard to find that way.
Super.
The most recent one is from Princeton University Press, so they could go to the Princeton University Press site and find it there as well.
I can't believe you were with me almost a year ago, come June. Jeez.
It has gone quickly, but it's nice to be back, George.
Oh, it's always great to have you, too. You know, one day we've got to do a show on time. I think Einstein was on to something. Why does it seem like time seems to go by faster every year?
I think we're just getting older, George.
You think so? The clock's ticking, isn't it?
The clock's ticking, and we are enjoying the time we have left, but we every day that goes by, we know we have fewer of them ahead of us.
Let's go to Jack in Rochester, New York. Happens to be a first-time caller for us. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, George. How are you?
Okay. Hope you are, too.
Thank you for having me on. I've never called in before. I drive a salt truck in the winter, and I get to listen to you at night.
Thank you for what you do, because you save a lot of people in the winter.
Doing something important.
I appreciate that. What I wanted to say is, recently, Jimmy Kimmel had George Bush 2 on that night, not too long ago, and he asked George Bush a question. He said, "Is there alien life out there? You're the president. You would know." And he said that he would not answer that question. And he said that he went on to say that his daughter asked him the same question, and that he gave her the same answer, that he would not discuss that with her, which kind of to me would indicate that they know something that maybe we don't know. And I wanted to know what you guys thought about that. And I will take my question off the air. Thank you.
I don't think a lot of standing presidents know too much about the possible extraterrestrial presence. I think Nixon might have been one, but not a lot. I think all the others were left in the dark. David, of course, you don't believe we've been visited, but it is an incredibly perplexing possibility.
I don't think we've been visited, but I would say if we had evidence that we'd been visited during the 8 years that the second George Bush was president, that is a discovery that would rise to the level of informing the president of the United States. So, yeah, he would know. But I think George Bush on late night TV is smart enough to know that there's some entertainment value here and some intrigue, and that he also doesn't know the answer, and therefore he provided a fun way of answering the question with a non-answer. Politicians are very good at knowing how to not answer questions, but also not provide definitive answers to anything.
And, of course, Jimmy Kimmel has asked the same question to Bill Clinton, to Hillary, to President Barack Obama, and gets the same answer.
Yeah, none of them have any more information than any of the rest of us have.
Next up, we've got George in Pennsylvania. Hello there, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, George, Dave here. I got a conundrum for you. If you're a builder of an anti-gravity craft, Tesla method, and it's in your lab, you know it works.
Right.
You know it's running. It's generally the effect starts at 700 revolutions per minute. That's a braking speed of 14,000 between the two polarities. And you know it's working. It's lifting up, can lift the weight. But when you look at it, though, you're saying, whoa, what's happening? I've knocked off one leg of space-time. I know that I have static magnetic field independent of electromagnetic field by nature of the coiling making magnetic field. We know magnetic field, if it gets hotter, it loses its polarity. We know that if it's polarity and out in space, it gets pretty hot. And then we also know that it will have celestial sound, meaning a compressed wave, de-energizes it, starts the cooling process, it comes back, and basically you come down and you'll say, you know what, all this mass is static electric magnetic field locked. And then I get back to my thinking like I'm talking to you, and there's not one piece of my carbon doing this except magnetic static field. Complex, though. What do you think, Dave?
I'm not an engineer, and I don't actually understand most of what you were trying to explain to me.
George is a genius.
I don't know what an anti-gravity machine would be, because you can't escape gravity. Gravity exists everywhere in the universe. But you can make a rocket to try to escape from the Earth's nearby gravitational field. You can experience weightlessness in orbit around the Earth, but you're still experiencing gravity. So I don't actually know what the devices are that you've been trying to describe to me.
It is amazing the possibilities when you let your mind wander what could be going on out there. Tom in the Bronx, it's your turn, Thomas. Go ahead.
Yes. I'd like to say it's all fascinating that you can have rocket ships go from the moon to Mars and beyond and all, but like if India and China don't do something about all this pollution in other parts of the world as well, we're going to look like the moonscape of the moon and Mars combined. It's, in other words, we're in for a lot of problems. And don't forget the ozone layer that's giving out. If that goes, we're going to have a lot more trouble with a lot of rays coming down, and you're going to have a lot of people with more skin cancers and everything else.
I think you're absolutely right. We need to take care of this planet. One of the reasons we try to explore other planets is to learn about how planets work, about how atmospheres change, how the surfaces of planets interact with atmospheres. That's how we learned about the depletion of the ozone layer. That's how we learned there was an ozone layer in the first place. That's how we learned that the ozone layer protects us from ultraviolet light from the sun. All of these are important scientific discoveries that help us better understand how we need to do things on this planet in order to take care of this planet. I think we've been lousy stewards of this planet, and we absolutely have to do better.
How close can we get, David, to seeing the first light of the Big Bang?
We can get within, well, at the moment, we can get within about 300,000 years.
That's close.
We can go back, 13.7 billion years. We can go back very, very close to the beginning. Right now, we can't see beyond that, but you're familiar with the phrase, George Washington slept here?
Mm-hmm.
And by that we mean, in effect, if someone is lying in a bed and they get out of the bed, you might still see the impression they left in the bed, even though you don't see them. And what we can do is we can see the impression that the light from the Big Bang made, even though we can't see all the way back to the very beginning. But we're getting close.
Let's go to Dave in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hey, gentlemen. Maybe the Big Bang will turn out to be the flat Earth of the 21st century.
You never know.
Yeah, and some quick observations and then a question.
Sure.
And George, for you, knowing the origin of the universe would be the equivalent, as I see it, of actually knowing God himself. And that I believe that the Israeli lunar payload launched today from Cape Canaveral on SpaceX. And that bacteria, that any bacteria on the outside of any of our satellites orbiting our Earth, to me, obviously came from Earth. And that quickening thing you had mentioned, time quickening,
mm-hmm.
I believe that's simply a factor of that the longer we've been in existence as a person, the smaller fraction a given unit of time is to our overall existence, as evidenced by, I remember, I got in trouble with my mom because I had a temper tantrum when I was like 4 years old, 5 years old. It was in July, within a couple days of that lunar landing. And I asked how long until we go to grandma's house. And my mom said an hour. And that was an eternity. And I had a temper tantrum. And then, fast forward 50 years and an hour is like the snap of your fingers. And I think that's what that is. Carter, there was an incident where Carter was handed some documents, and I don't know the veracity of this. This is just something I gathered somewhere, that Carter was handed some documents or some information on presumably extraterrestrial life, and he was in his office alone at his desk, and he began to weep. I don't know if that rings any bells with anybody or if that was even real. I don't know. Einstein won the fellow physicist. Oh, first of all, Mr. Weintraub, do you have any family in Minnesota?
No, I do not. Not in Minnesota.
I knew some there. The Einstein won, fellow physicist of yours won the Nobel Prize in 1921. Cousin of mine, Ernest Orlando Lawrence, won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1939, I believe it was, for particle physics, for inventing the cyclotron. And I was going to ask you, does any of the work of Lawrence have any bearing on the work that you do today?
Not on mine. I think Lawrence worked on particle physics, but I'm not real familiar with his work.
And by the way, Israel's first space mission is on its way to the moon, launched tonight by SpaceX. So here we go, another country joining the space race.
That is exciting. Of course, Israel didn't actually launch the rocket.
No.
So they've got a
They own the satellite.
They own the satellite, but not the rocket.
Well, now that's interesting, because they had to hire out to a private firm to do that. But I would guess the Israelis, though, will handle the technology of the satellite, right?
That's right. I think SpaceX's only job is launching the payload.
Just getting it up there.
Yeah. And the spacecraft itself, I would imagine, has its own rockets that will take it from near-Earth orbit to the moon. But I'm not familiar with this particular rocket or payload.
Let's go to Aaron in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hello, Aaron. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, George, how are you doing tonight?
Okay, I'm fine. Thanks.
Good to speak to you again. I was going to ask another question, but I wanted to touch on what the gentleman was saying earlier about the anti-gravity.
Sure.
If you go onto the internet and you see this gentleman who's come up with this device, it's like a weight, like, you know, would you lift weights? But one end of it has no weight on it. The other end has like 150 pounds weight. And you'll put a drill onto the weights and spin them at about 3,000 revolutions in between two bearings. And when they start spinning, you can pick up from the one end the 150 pounds with one hand, you know, spinning around your head like it's completely weightless, you know.
That's dramatic, yeah. They're getting close to weightlessness.
Yeah. And the last question I was going to ask you is about when the Russians sent the satellites to Mars some years back. And remember, one of them had crashed, and the second one sent back a bunch of pictures. And the last picture showed a shadow on Mars. And, you know, they were supposedly going to release the very last picture, and they didn't release it for years. They said it wasn't the shadow of the satellite itself, but it was some other source. I was just wondering what your guests thought about
all
that.
All right. Did you hear about that, David? Apparently it was supposed to be, the rumor was, an object of some type came and gobbled up that Mars satellite.
I'm not familiar with it. The Russians were never very successful at sending spacecraft to other planets. So I think they just lack the technological skills in their space program to be successful doing that.
By the way, when's the last time they launched a satellite publicly for some purpose for another planet?
Certainly for a scientific project, it's been decades.
I don't think
Russia has done it. It's been since the Soviet Union times.
All they really do is get astronauts and cosmonauts up to the ISS.
That's right. I don't think they have a very advanced space program anymore, but they certainly have the ability to continue to do what they've been doing for decades, which is to launch humans into near-Earth orbit.
We're almost out of time here, my friend. David Weintraub with us, the physicist. His books, Life on Mars, What to Know Before We Go, Religions and Extraterrestrial Life, How Will We Deal with It? That's what we talked about last year with David. His website is part of Vanderbilt University, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. David, in parting words, what would you like to tell everybody?
I would like everybody who's listening to just keep paying attention to what's going on. There are tremendous discoveries being made in science, including in astronomy right now. And the more people who are aware of those discoveries, the better off we all are. We need to be knowledgeable about the science that we're learning.
Absolutely. David, thanks for being on the show. Let's get you back on again, okay?
Okay. Good night, George.
Absolutely. Take care. Great. I love talking to scientists. They just, you know, even though they're not into extraterrestrial life and UFOs, they are very fascinating to talk with. Up next, we're going to talk about poltergeists, moving graveyards, haunted hospitals, medical professionals who have had strange encounters with the unusual and the paranormal. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM.